This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm going to do something a little different for myself and for you today. I'm going to actually kind of combine three different themes in the issues around factory architecture and urbanism that I've been working on. So some of my talk I will read and some I will show, talk more directly to the slides. I think that though we should wait for questions maybe at certain points or at the end, so please do think of questions and issues. And I'm going to raise a lot of questions also for all of us to think about. What I've been working on isn't, there aren't answers for everything. And there are also social issues around industry, of course, and the workplace and labor that I'm really not addressing fully. But I want you to know that, of course, I'm aware of these too. You'll see some of it, but not all of that. So what I'd like to... And I have a nice couch here to sit on. Can you all see and hear me? Yeah, okay. So I'm going to, just because I know you're all doing work in theory, I want you to know that I've been inspired by and I've liked to reference in this work the work of Guy Debord, Henri Lefebvre, David Harvey, Saskia Sassen, and some economists, like, I don't know if you're familiar with The World is Flat by Friedman and Stieglitz's work. So it's kind of a combination of work on space and architecture, but also, of course, architecture doesn't live alone. And that's one reason why I'm so interested in factories as an architecture type as well, because it is so influenced by everything around it. So it combines very many different layers of themes that I've been working on, from issues of technology with Fordism and Toyota in terms of the methods of actually making products to the spectacular in terms of design versus that of the everyday shed in the globalized economics of the world. And then we'll look at the end on the potential for the future of urban networks, vertical industries as kind of what we could call neo-cottage industries in cities. And so we're looking at kind of this historic overview today, but also looking towards the future. So it's a lot of material to look at. But I'd like to start with talking a little bit about the early issues in mass production and ideas of economics, as David Harvey has identified that with mass production, there was an increased need for flexibility in spaces of production. And flexible accumulation in transient economic times, such as today, must follow when there's this new globalized economy that's in constant flux, so that automation and control are essential to these manufacturing zones. Both centralized production management and financial power that agglomerated in the 1980s in key cities, as described by Saskia Sassen, are now transforming and becoming even more dispersed. The new model could be a renewed potential for decentralized workforce and for places of production that will invigorate not only a new economic web, but also local places where objects can be made in clustered urban networks as well as far afield in the global economy. The shrinking scale of technologies and facilities has also enabled the potential of the mobile worker within complexly networked systems, forming a new paradigm for urban production spaces of the future. In terms of economic theory, David Harvey calls the phase post-Ford and that of a more Toyota mentality one of this flexible accumulation, wherein the flexible patterns of the markets, products, and patterns of consumption include new financial services, new markets, and intensity, as well as new industries that we are seeing in the developing worlds. And those of places such as Silicon Valley and California or Route 158 around Boston. It includes flexible time, specific needs of firms, new management, and subcontracted and temporary workforces. It also changed labor to a new sweatshop-type condition and small manufacturers, as well as informal economies in our own advanced capitalized world, which is really more similar now to the third world than we thought. This flux and economic times contribute to an innovation in fast-paced development as well as more specific market niches. Production can continue to flow, and there is no need for large amounts of warehousing or unsold goods. This relates to architecture in the ephemeral and spectacle fashion of style and taste and culture. In addition to new global financial systems, this has changed the way the market is driven, which is the opposite to the solidity of Fordism. The individual can participate and control both the financing and the product they want as consumers. The new flexible accumulation has led to new strategies for technologies and labor, as well as older systems that provide alternatives and more choice in eclectic production methods. Henri Lefebvre, the social philosopher who you probably studied, defines ideas of what is now called spatial practice, that of architects and others who deal with issues of the organization and design of space and land use. For me, I can look at this in terms of his concepts of factory design and apply that to factory design, in that it is a material flow and organizational management that defines the space of production and how people inhabit that space, which has influenced the way industry has changed and also therefore influenced urban space. I will review some of these key organizational and management production methods of interchangeable parts, which is the American system, later mass production, mass customization, and just-in-time manufacturing, and all the way to what I also now call real-time manufacturing, so that you have some background in this here. So have any of you studied mass production methods, or are you familiar with Ford and industry a little? Have any of you worked in a factory? That's sometimes interesting. No? Huh?
Printing shop.
Printing shop? Okay. So I'm just going to review some of this so you have a context with which to look forward. So in the mid-19th century, what we see is an early form of mass production, which people often forget, and I always like to make this point, that Ford did not invent the assembly line. This is an old etching from actually the early 19th century of a can factory, and you can see very much that it is a production line. This kind of a line system was used by many of the rifle manufacturers, such as Colt in Hartford, or Remington in New Haven, and Whitney. And what they did was they would make their machines, their guns, or the other fields would be bicycles or sewing machines, and they would make them with standardized parts. Parts of each of these machines or these technologies were similar, and therefore they could change them out for repair or for safety, and therefore there could be a line of production where these parts were assembled in a line, put together in a line, and then if someone had a problem with one of them in the future, they could bring them back and just that small piece would be replaced. It's something that Siegfried Gideon also talks about in his book Mechanization Takes Command, where he talks quite a bit about sewing machines, and it became a fascination also for architects. Now, the thing about this became known as the American system of manufacturers, but the factories themselves were pretty stagnant places, mainly because they had to be associated with an energy source. So you see here, let's see, how do I do this? This factory is above a water source. So just like the old mills in Lowell, Mass., or even on the Manioc River here in Philadelphia, these buildings were run by the power there. The floor layouts were rigid and inflexible, and because of this very kind of stationary kind of electricity, they were really cluttered. The factories were cluttered with belts and they were, you know, a jungle of elements to reach to the power sources. So the factories themselves were inflexible and all the machines were very stationary. The workers didn't move their full bodies and they developed repetitive hand and arm motions, which led to fatigue and eventual injury. And really, in these early systems of manufacturing, humans really served as motors. They were the motors. And a social historian, Rabinach, has written about this and the whole issue of human fatigue and the motor being that of the person, so that they really were always controlling machines, but everything that they did was done in a similar fashion. At this time as well, at the turn of the century, America especially was interested in efficiency and economy, and they wanted to use the least amount of materials, have the least amount of labor, and produce as much as they could. At the same time, other assembly lines were being developed. This is one with Westinghouse, where actually the goods could go on the line and on the belt and move out. This very much influenced the work of Frederick Taylor in 1912, who developed something called his work was called Taylorism, and it relates to the idea of efficiency and control. And he was an economist and a sociologist, and he very much would study how systems could be more efficient, how organizations could be more efficient. And this was picked up by Henry Ford, but also by the Galbraiths. Have you heard of the Galbraiths before? Who did motion studies. And this is one of their studies. They actually are the subject of the book Cheaper by the Dozen, which I'm sure you know, which became a film. And the Galbraiths were so interested in organizational management and control of the worker that he ran his family in the same way he would run people in a factory. So what you see here is these tests that they did. On this woman's wrist is a light, and this was also very influential in early photography. Maury, who was a French photographer, also used light, or even looking at Muybridge's early movement studies. So this idea that you could capture movement on film and then study how people moved and how they could control their bodies was dominant. And so here you have this light attached to her wrist, and you see two different ways of stacking paper. So on the left, she's doing it in a line, and you can see the numbers of moves that she makes. Her moves are traced by the light. And then on the right, the same thing, but look how much more efficient her moves are. So the Galbraiths did this with numerous studies, tracking them, using these grids, using clocks to understand how people moved and the most efficient way to do it. This was then taken up by Henry Ford, who used these same methods to run his factory. Taylorism, of course, was also influential in Europe with many of the corporations there, and they all followed this idea of scientific management, of control of the worker, of efficient production. Many of us know these stories of Henry Ford. This is Highland Park in Detroit. And at the time, though, what's interesting about the manufacturing is that really it was mass production. One machine, one car. In 1912, you could only buy a Model T. It was only in black. There was no choice at all in the kind of product. And you could see, though, that he was very clever in the manufacturing methods. Typical of these vertical factories, they would bring the parts to the top floor, and then the car would be manufactured going down through the factory floor. This is really a mock-up on the outside of the factory just to show how it would work, how the chassis was lowered into the car. But the idea of using gravity and using the flow of the verticality of the factory was important with this. This also allowed different engines to be assembled and very fast production. You can see kind of the massiveness of this kind of a factory floor. at multiple layers. But the thing is that any time they wanted to change the design of a car, they would have to re-engineer or retool, they call it, the entire factory. So this wasn't done very often. They would have to stop the production line and change out the entire thing. So you wouldn't see car designs change very often in those years. But in contrast, in America, by 2003, computer mechanization had increased the possibilities for mass customization to such a degree that the Lansing, Michigan GM plant was able to produce one car in less than 17 hours. So in less than a day, you could now produce an automobile compared to what it took days to do in 1912. The interesting thing, just as an aside, this GM plant was advertised when it was built that it could change out production and change the type of car that was being made there three or four times, but in reality it never happened. And you can see why GM failed, because they had these great ideas, but really they were still back in the era of Ford in terms of the way they produced their cars. So the next phase of this is to show also a diagram that a student did of a Nike production line in China, and this kind of also still very linear system even recently that these production sheds had, that it really isn't very much advanced from Ford when you go to a very simple production line as you have here. Also with the post-war factories as well. But automated production made a huge leap when the computer harnessed new systems for urgent demands of the military-industrial complex in World War II. And additional manufacturing methods were enhanced with concept developed by Toyota Motor called just-in-time production. It used the Kaizen system of teamwork to encourage social interaction, employee responsibility, and creativity in the production line. Toyota also emphasized not having waste or not overstocking their products or their parts. This method was perfected by Toyota, but it was actually a philosophical system developed by an American who was Edward Deming. He had studied in the States with Schuart and was the inventor of something called total quality management. Deming had assisted manufacturers in the war, and he had taught Japanese scientists the idea of quality control. And this term you hear a lot in production now. You hear a lot just in time, you hear quality control, you hear terms like lean management, and these are all the methods that they used. And one of the things that helped in the factory is something called an Andon board. Have any of you heard of that? This is the Andon board here. And Andon in Japanese means a lantern. And it's basically a light that lights up with all of the different information of the manufacturing line so that you could see on it what is happening. Here they have, I guess, I don't know exactly how this works, but the goal of the number of products they're making, how many they have made, where they are on the assembly line. And this is in the middle of a production line or an aisle of the production floor. And all of the factories can look at this. It's really a feedback loop, right? It's very related to the idea of cybernetics, and that you can look at what the machine is doing and have the workers respond to that and take care of scheduling and timing, maybe missing items on a production line. And then when something is missing, they can quickly replace it and get it back in line. Using this, the employees can self-regulate and relieve production bottlenecks. That's one of the big issues in manufacturing, is you don't want a machine to stall, and then you get a bottleneck of everything backing up for assembly. And as they gaze to the board, they see problem areas prior to the machine malfunctioning, and they can act more efficiently as a team through a collaborative process. In the design of factories by architects and engineers, teamwork was also further expressed at this time in the 60s and 70s, in the design of factories where maybe there would be common entrances, where employees that are both the blue collars and the white collars, as shown here, come in together, into the factory together. They might share common rooms or lunchrooms or workspaces. And this idea of collaboration was key. A factory worker on the floor at BMW in South Carolina was given a jumpsuit, and they're called associates, just the same way that McDonald's calls their cashiers associates or managers. So the idea that the laborer was given more prominence was also relevant at this time. However, when factory automation and distribution networks replaced the worker with the monotonous rhythm of machines, production became controlled with the touch of a button rather than through the completion of multiple tasks by skilled workers. Cultural critics such as Lewis Mumford in the 1950s praised the new technologies but derided its lack of humanism. By the 1970s, computer controls and CNC machines were attached to older equipment, like you see here, and it was integrated in a piecemeal way. They would just take new controls and put them on the old machines, and then also they would add, even later, computer controls for CAD and CNC milling to produce these objects. In many factories, workers sat at one station, operating machines via computer programs or just assembling things by hand, and they were bored from the repetitive activity. And thus we have Charlie Chaplin's spoof on the factory in the Moving Modern Times. The other thing that started to happen in the 60s is an advent of use of logistics for goods distribution in global manufacturing networks. Since the ultimate goal was to increase globalized economy and reach the consumer, integrating the feedback loop between supply and demand in a combined factory, warehouse, retail outlet was essential. Spatially, this meant that central places of control were networked in a broader centralized economy, where physical distance no longer mattered, and objects moved fluidly from country to country. Companies from Benetton Apparel to Nike to Zara to BMW embraced the new ease at mass customization and customer feedback, subcontracting production to an outsourced network of nearby and more distant manufacturers to reduce their operating costs with cheaper labor, less overhead costs, taking advantage of each local area's labor specialization. Toyota outsourced its manufacturing to local companies. So you start to see companies that made their own networks. Ford did this with small parts around Detroit. Toyota did this also around its main plants, and they networked with smaller manufacturers. This also was happening with Benetton in northern Italy, and in the Bologna region of Italy, where smaller factories making shoes would all be networked together as a way to save these industries in the mid-70s. At the same time, stores such as Benetton started to identify the way the consumer interacted with their products. This idea was called the prosumer by the futurist Alvin Toffler. And he identified the way consumers would react to products. Benetton installed data interchange feedback mechanisms, which would notify the warehouses what items were missing or need to be stocked from the shelves, so that the retail clerk could punch into their computer what was selling and what color was most popular. And that would be then networked back to the warehouse and then to the manufacturer, so they would know what they needed to increase in their production line. The Benetton model is one of the most renowned in this way, and one of their methods was that they would make most of the sweaters white originally in white wool and then dye them according to the colors that were most popular. And this was funny because just recently I was talking with an old friend and found out she had worked at Benetton in the early days. when this was going on. And she said, yes, at the end of every season, she ended up with a pile of white sweaters because they never would bother to dye them until they knew exactly what they wanted. So this was very influential in terms of feedback to the consumer that we now are taking for granted because of what we can do on the computer with mass customization. And it also influenced the design of the factory because you see here these large warehouse alleyways, new methods of transport, so that there was always much more room for the truck in these factories. They became much more integrated as distribution centers as well. They used also, these systems called that were auto ID tracking systems that are now getting even more developed. So what you see in these factories up to this point are these ideas where design and production research methods are all combined to monitor a fluid distribution system within the factory and in the chain of command. And this is often looked at by scientists or philosophers such as even Kevin Kelly, who started to look at this idea of production as a superorganism if you look now at the globalized world and how it's working. But in terms of the factory of architecture, there also are two ways that I've been finding that things have been directing, very similar to anything that we find in architecture in terms of the percentage of influence that an architect might have on the design of a building. I mean, as you all know, architects really only design about 5% of residential housing in this country. It's the same with factories. But what's interesting is that when an architect is hired to design a factory, it is done in a very spectacular way. And that's why it's interesting to pair this with the work of Guy Debord to talk about the society of the spectacle and how the architect is responsible for also the marketing of the company by the design of their building. So we see a great example here in Dresden, Germany, this is a cigarette company, and it's designed much more like a Turkish mosque even. And the idea is to show off the company, to have the company be, the building be part of the marketing efforts of that company. And then even when Peter Behrens designed the AEG company, if you've studied that at all, he really was hired to develop a brand for AEG, both also in terms of their product design and industrial design of objects that they would sell, but also in terms of their factory. So here his idea in 1909 was to make the factory like a temple, right? This was always considered a temple front. I'm not going to go into all the technological and architectural issues now, but this just to take this idea that it's a marketing tool for the factory. He wanted it prominent. It's on a corner. It can be seen from many angles. And at the same time, it was an engineering feat. The same was for the Fagus Works factory, also in Germany, that was designed by Gropius with an engineer. This idea of using this main administrative building as a showcase. So this idea that you could look into the factory, look into the buildings, and see it. So here we are beginning with this idea of the consumption of production, of people wanting to see how things are made, of wanting to look in the factories. And this was really at the ultimate with the Fiat factory in Lingotto that was designed by an engineer, Giacomo Trucco, and was very enamored by Le Corbusier, who came there as well. And it was built in 1929. And their idea was to put the testing track on the roof of the building. And it was often used for racing, but cars, of course, in those days couldn't go very fast, and there was a slope. But it was very much of a marketing tool for Fiat to have the racetrack or the testing track on the roof of the huge factory building. Another example is Boots, which is a pharmaceutical company in England. That the idea, of course, with modernism and modern architecture at the forefront was significant, but also that they wanted to create an elegant design. As with the Van Nella factory in Rotterdam, which was a cigarette and coffee and tea company, they wanted to create a very light and airy space for their workers, and worker comfort was also something that they took into consideration as they designed this showcase. Grimshaw, with the Financial Times building much later in the early 80s, also wanted people to be able to see into the printing plant so that you can actually see the papers being printed, that was part of the process and part of the thrill of making something. So the idea that you can show. And of course, for many companies that are in kind of the fashion-oriented business, the furniture-oriented business, we see them wanting to make showcase buildings. This is the L'Oreal perfume factory, which is designed in the shape of a flower for perfume, and had these catwalks throughout the building, and in a very high-end way. Then, of course, we have those factories, too, that are really, you know, the idea of the Venturian duck, which Philippe Starck designed for the knife company Languille, so that the knife becomes the emblem. Or Bernard Schumi's. These are all of the kind of spectacular, very rich in architectural detail factories. One of the most evident of this is the VW transparent factory in Dresden, designed by Günter Henn. This is a model that shows very clearly his ideas of the cars on a production line at the facade of the building so that people in the city can see what is being made. And this wasn't only important as a spectacle, but also in terms of reinvigorating a poor East German city after the wall came down, that the government invested money here to build this factory, to make it part of the city, and to make it a place really at the edge of a park where people would want to come buy their car in the very German way, where you go, you order your car, you go look at it in this cylinder on the right side of the building are fabric samples that you can see to decide what color you want your interior, and on the left is a restaurant even, and then when the cars are finished, they're stored in this garage tower, but all very visible to the consumer and also to the people of the city. So you can kind of see here the layout and the circulation with the assembly line here. Here's the assembly on multi-layers, and that they bring the parts into the city via tram line. But it's a very clean factory, right? This is not a dirty factory. It's not a place where a mess is made. It's very skilled workers. It's the same thing as in Zaha Hadid's BMW plant, where she was hired to make this connecting zigzag. It was won in a competition to create a connecting point between the main manufacturing areas. One is assembly, one is finishing, and the other storage, so that they all of these different areas of the plant come together through the design that she made for kind of a showpiece, for an entrance. And again, the workers, the blue-collar workers, the white-collar workers, they all enter in the same space. They all park in the same parking lot. They all have lunch in the same cafeteria. And here's the entrance. I was just there in July. And it's very dramatic. You don't feel like you're in a factory at all. Here are cars that you're not supposed to see because they're not yet announced. And the cars come through the administration level, which is down below, kind of as showpieces circulating on these conveyors, making it a showpiece both for the workers who are there, but also for the tourists who can come through and see the robots at work, and they make it very comfortable. You get to wear a jacket when you're a tourist on a tour there and see the factory in production. The other side of this factory kind of global issue is that there are factories that really are just sheds. I myself went through this kind of existential crisis when I thought, oh my gosh, you know, all you really need to make something is a space. You just need a shed and some air and some light, and you can make whatever you need, a car or a piece of clothing or a shoe. Because most of what we see in factory are not designed, right? Primarily, you have non-designed factories. And many of these are equated with issues in globalization, in what is called export processing zones, in places where the making of money is more important than the issues of the worker. So that what you have is that large companies outsource their production to the offshore locations to really neutral manufacturers, so that a lead company focuses not on that area where they're located, but on the manufacturing, on this production. And many of these manufacturing zones manufacture diverse products. They don't really have a need for image. They're just back-to-back in industrial parks, just like you see in North Philadelphia or in New Jersey, a grouping of sheds that are very cheap to house there, that don't really pay local taxes, that are in very simple spaces, and often they're all organized by one management company. You see this often in Mexico. This is an industrial park where they're advertising, leasing of these different parcels of land to different companies, and you can see all the names of the companies here that are there, the Philips or Honeywell, companies we recognize, General Electric, that all are on these sites pursuing global investments and but with a very restricted labor force and issues of politics that are always dominant. And in Mexico, these are really sweatshops or maquiladoras started with the NAFTA agreements, and they employ over 1 million people and contribute to Mexico's $150 billion annual exports. They make everything from car parts for Ford and VW and Honda to electronic parts for Pioneer and Casio and shoes for Nike and Reebok. When these companies outsource their factories to these kind of contractor manufacturers, the main company reduces the knowledge of their own manufacturing system. They have no laborers that they employ and no architecture. It's all subcontracted out. So the buildings are often just simple cinder block walls with a steel roof, and they often don't seal the walls at all. Their better versions have drop ceilings and air conditioned with delivery areas and the potential for tenant improvements. Still others are just shacks without light or ventilation or any kind of amenities. You can see how dark some of these interiors are, and they're really housed all under one roof. They're generic, and they epitomize kind of this idea of the mobile factory, the obsession with the economizing of time, space, and speed that makes the mobility of the production process really the model. Nomadic contractors can close up and move to a new shed to avoid taxes just when the taxes come due. Just as geese migrate south following the warm weather, the outsourced manufacturers follow the export processing and free trade zones. As they change or pull out, they also instill a fear. The factories in Mexico or on the U.S. border hover both physically and economically in a world in between that is neither here nor there, and they have no services and no investments. Godemard, a philosopher in France, said, is the fate of the worker thus tied to a future in which only two possibilities remain, to be a controller of flux or an element of flux? So you get this other total extreme, right, of the factory as the shed with no identity. But there are some companies that are kind of in between. One is the company called Flextronics, and they're more committed to their place in many ways and their own innovative, flexible manufacturing processes. And they have plants in Mexico, California, and Canada. And what they do is the same kind of industrial park, but theirs are a little nicer. I mean, you know, the workers are treated a little better. They're managed. They try to have some design in them. The architect was actually proud when I asked him for photographs. He has some crazy sidewalks here. I don't know what the curve is, but you can see kind of, again, though, they're very generic in their design, more like a shopping mall, but also a little more pride, like a corporate park in how they work. And these places, they have soccer fields, they have cafeterias, there's community commitment, and the parts all come in one end of a larger factory and leave a completed product out the other, just any like any other kind of manufacturing assembly line. But this one is flexible and adaptable to an array of products, whether they're the guts for cell phones for Ericsson or printers for Hewlett-Packard. Basically, what this company has worked out is that they supply everything for inside of almost every kind of electronic. So the idea of separate factories making different things that you then buy is imaginary. Many of these things are all made in the same kind of place. Another example I've been looking at is that of Manila, where, again, they have these same issues of export processing zones and poverty, and the idea that the government wanted to create these zones in order to encourage their economic power. But again, we have these same issues of employees, many women who come, they're temporary workers, they don't get benefits, and they're paid very minimally, just like in, you've heard probably in China, they're bused to their workplace or they live in dormitories nearby. And much of this had to do with the expansion of the Southeast Asian trade agreements, where now Manila and the Philippines are part of that with China. And that they're very, very forward-thinking in how they want to lure foreign and local companies to their areas. Just to show, again, what these export processing zones do is that they're very managed. They have, they set up sites for different factories to be located there. They have their security system with bikers. They supply fresh water. They supply electricity. They define all the zoning regulations in terms of where you're allowed to build on these sites when you build a factory, or they supply the factory shed for you to just walk in and use. This area was written about by Naomi Klein. And as a journalist, you know, she describes everything fully, but she never really showed you what these places looked like. So I did further research to see what she was talking about and was able to get information from these export processing zones to understand better how they function, but also learning that many of them have social issues and social problems. And last year, they were the ones that had the strikes against Walmart. They were the ones that were really violently attacked in this area and abused by the main companies. But you see, nobody knew who these workers were. They're not Walmart's employees. They're transient workers who work for a subcontractor who then sells everything to Walmart. So you can see this kind of trickle down also affects in the place of work and how they're treated in that workplace and the environment for the worker. So what I would like to now look at kind of in the last little bit here is kind of what the hope for the future might be. And looking at these issues of both the global and global commerce and global economics, but also on kind of an industrial ecology or ideas expressed by the economist Stiglitz with better treatment for concerns for the countries where this globalization is taking place. And to me, it is a focus that needs attention because we don't see it. It's not in our on our main streets. It's not in our front yards. We don't really see this happening. We still buy, you know, I'm not here to, you know, be a communist to go against the, what's going on in capitalism, but, you know, we all still buy cheap clothes. We all still buy the things that we can afford. But I do think it's important to look at this and to see what possible new options there could be in our urban environments. And one thing that I've become fascinated with is the way the smaller technologies have been allowing us to disperse the kind of manufacturing that we do so that we've gone from these large-scale machines that I showed in the beginning and the large-scale assembly lines to the just-in-time of the assembly lines and products turning over faster. And now with this even more expansive distributed networks, there are ways that our machinery can work in our favor and that the idea of new handheld controls in factories or the idea of handheld controls in one location operating a factory in another location can extend that. And this is similar to these networks analyzed by Paul Barron for the RAND Corporation in the 1960s, where rather than emphasizing the hierarchical system, there's a distributed network with extended branches of communication. And what this does is it could give the worker more control and more hands-on understanding in a way, but the control is through this smaller device. The reorganization of production spaces then can result where the handheld machinery parallels the workflow of the organizational network and where there are real-time adjustments for continually changing circumstances across these fields of operation, which is something that Luther Gerlach, an organizational sociologist, defined. With shrinking of controls, high-powered handhelds communicate between departments and to and from robots on the factory floor for scheduling, maintenance, and inventory. Let's see. Workers can track repairs and work on this machinery remotely, which can enhance the productivity of the mobile worker and increase the flexibility of divisions of labor and their specific location of on the factory floor. Many computer hardware and software companies, such as Cisco, SAP, Accenture, and Oracle, have created systems which all run programs on handhelds. And we're familiar with this from the FedEx man or the UPS man, who is using this as well as they go around in their own little mobile workplace. They use these bar scanners to check and control production processes through embedded chips, resulting in synchronicity with communications in real-time production. They can use wireless PDAs for quality control, and it's often seen, especially in the food and beverage business, where you're not seeing in the giant tanks, for example, in a brewery, how the product is made, but you're controlling it with buttons from the outside or with these handhelds. Or it's something also for nuclear power plants, where it's safer to be away from the plant and you control it from afar. When the various components of a product such as a car need to be changed, just as in the early interchangeable parts manufacturing of the 19th century, computer-controlled robots can control the job and directed by the workers on their handheld PCs. They can move components virtually, and the production process is programmed in the computer and tested often in simulations until perfected. So rather than the large-scale and onboard that is visible to all, each worker can negotiate the issues on their individualized screens, and teamwork can continue, but on a much more kind of virtual level. Another system under development, and this is what's pictured here, is something from the Fraunhofer Institute in Germany, and it's an intelligent networked manufacturing system called InManus that foresees further use of wireless and smart controls, which will network people, machines, and robots for smart production, using sensors and cameras embedded in the equipment. In this process, computers don't get reprogrammed with each change in design, but new information is input into the system that adapts the smart connected platform fluidly. Oh, wait, let me go back here. Computers are also enhanced with more mobile controls and headsets for workers, and they can display everything simultaneously and work together. The scenario really is like that of a puppeteer controlling the actions of a puppet with a virtual string attached to each movable element controlled by a central hub. The information flow allows instant decision-making that improves productivity, flexibility, and ultimate profitability. Corporations can have their front office and knowledge centers in major cities, the way Saskia Soskin has discussed, and take advantage of dispersed labor throughout the city or in nearby areas. Urbanistically, the automated mobile industry technologies can impact spatial configurations at the larger scale of the city, not only focusing on the globalization of industry that we've seen between distant locations. But there's a foreseeable potential for increased industrial urbanization taking advantage of proximity and clustering across the city, which becomes a sustainable manufacturing method in terms of distribution networks at the local level. The factories of the Industrial Revolution, which grew by accretion, might be revitalized in vertical urban settings with a potential for smaller production, linked by virtual connections with more flexible investments in manufacturing. Imagine automated digital controls formalizing links between urban cottage-type industries with tabletop robotic computers with computer-aided manufacturing between urban districts, making mega-scaled horizontal suburban factories with the formerly all-under-roof elements obsolete. Small companies could print out their products from CNC-controlled stereolithography, the way you do in architecture school, on their desktops. Rather than congealing into major corporations, they can splinter into networks of local manufacturing at a smaller scale. This is happening, as I mentioned before, in northern Italy, but also in Norway, and ideas of unmanned manufacturing in Japan. With automation in former Western industrial city centers, existing industrial buildings have the potential to be networked together to capitalize. So here you see the example of this kind of the older Ford factory in this giant shed to a new small fashion designer who actually does have his own kind of little neo-cottage industry in Soho in a former industrial loft. So we start to see this returning bit by bit. That now you can see, expanding on the current scenario that's really happening in the garment district, a more intensely virtually networked community of manufacturers. That the garment district could be reborn, modeled on its former organization, but virtually linked in clusters. A designer could complete a design, send the drawing digitally to a pattern maker, who is linked to the sample fabricator, who then transfers it, and then it is all assembled and checked in feedback networks via possibly handheld computers or via networked computers. So, it's interesting to start to look at, can now the factory as a place of work programmatically reinsert its relevance in the urban fabric with all of these issues that we've been talking about, free trade and globalization and need for image? Can manufacturing be more local? Can we make cities more self-sufficient with the factory returning to our formerly industrial cities? And what would this landscape look like with new factories again or re-inhabiting the old factories? And then we also have to ask economically, of course, is this viable? What is practical for today? What will people invest in? And how we can then expand it to a larger labor network? And we all know that some things will be made cheaper overseas. We can't deny that. We can't deny that it is still a lot cheaper for a clothing manufacturer to make thousands and millions of t-shirts overseas than it is in a small factory in New York, but that perhaps there are some niche markets that are more versatile that could be regenerated in our cities. The scale of the multinational corporation could be more splintered and reduced, returning to the ideas of small is beautiful or smallness within bigness, which is something that Schumacher, the economist from the 70s, often discussed. With these new advents in mass customization, we really have more advantages to kind of transform the spaces of manufacturing as well as the organization of them. And just to show you a few real examples, in closing, that indeed there are some companies who have decided to go this route. One you know, which is American Apparel, and they even always call themselves the vertical factory. They have been able to stay in LA and to manufacture their products all in one building with a warehouse adjacent. And they're very committed to this idea of making things in LA and also using their workforce in a local way. Another interesting example is in Switzerland, in Zurich, the Freitag bag company. You probably all, or some of you probably have those bags. They're all made also in a former factory in the middle of Zurich, where they're also recycling materials from truck tarps into these designer bags. And in New York now, in the Brooklyn Navy Yards, there is an effort to bring in more manufacturing. And this is the first new industrial vertical building in New York built probably in about 80 years. And some photo producers are going in here, and they have small wind turbines on the roof of this company. Of course, another way to explore these ideas is through architecture studios. So this is a studio I did at Parsons where the students each had different sites in the city and were designing vertical factories that also had to have some kind of a showroom or a store in the front to kind of make it relate to the urban environment. A bicycle manufacturing kind of sliver in the middle of the garment district here where the student also made like a test track for the biker to go on in the adjacent parking lot, so that there are these, of course, very creative ways to do this, and whether the economics would work is something that we're still not sure of. But one factory that I always love is that of course, the genius Buckminster Fuller, who designed a vertical cotton mill similar to those in the 19th century, where he also was obsessed, again, with his dome framework, but was able to integrate the verticality of this into a setting where all the machinery was what was on display in the factory. So one of the other issues is that of creating this new spatial paradigm of production, consumption, and recycling in a synergetic feedback loop that could provide renewed resources and energy, integrating our industries back into the city in this new hybrid use for urban infrastructures, and thus having manufacturing once again part of our everyday. Thank you.